Hello and welcome to episode 35 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name is Rebecca Thompson. I wrote the first investigation into this story for Computer Weekly back in 2009. My co-presenter is Nick Wallace, who wrote the book The Great Post Office Scandal. This week, our podcast features an interview with the former Post Office Minister, Paul Scully. Paul Scully took office at the Business Department in February 2020 and left in July 2022 when he moved to the Department for Levelling Up. On the 13th of November this year, Mr. Scully was reshuffled out of government and returned to the backbenches. Nick got in touch and asked if he'd be willing to recount his experiences of working inside the government on the post office scandal. Mr. Scully kindly agreed, and this is the result. Another Nick solo interview recorded remotely on the 19th of December 2023.
Mr. Scully, welcome. Thanks very much for agreeing to do this podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Really good to speak to you, Nick.
Okay, what I'm very interested in is your role as the post office minister and how your view of the scandal developed from when you took office, which I think was in February 2020, until you left office in 2022. And just to paint the picture, we had the settlement to the group litigation in December 2019, and immediately there was parliamentary activity. There was a call in the House of Lords for an independent public inquiry, and Lord Duncan, who was then the Post Office Minister in the Lords, suggested instead that the government would manifest change through a new national framework, though didn't volunteer what that actually meant. Then you took office, and then Lord Callanan, who replaced Lord Duncan, said in the House of Lords on the 24th of February, very silent on the likelihood of any kind of investigation or inquiry, and he actually stated the government do not propose to take any further action against current or former directors. So when you took office, what was your briefing about where you were, where the government was with this scandal from your civil servants?
Yeah, I haven't gone through any papers in preparation to speak to you today, so it's very much off the top of my head memory. But essentially, it's exactly as you said. I think the prevailing view at the time in the department was that the Justice Fraser had made his pronouncements. There's a thousand page of documents there. A lot has been said, and it's not for government to then get involved in that prosecution and that litigation, rather. And so, you know, we talked around it for quite a while, but it was just clear that wasn't just going to stand. It was, you know, this is definitely by far the best thing, although it's unfinished, the best thing I'll ever do in politics. And, you know, I've really had some kind plaudits. But it's appalling that that's the case, because all I did was human being first, politician second, and it took someone to actually just take a breath and step back and say, this isn't right. You know, you can't just do this by process. There are human beings involved in this that have just gone through so much. And that's that was the change, I think.
Well, that's what I'm fascinated by, because the way that your public pronouncements changed over a two-year period were giving glimpses as to what might be going on behind the scenes. And I appreciate, you know, you're not working from contemporaneous documents as you speak to me, but I just want to get a sense of who you were having conversations with, because no one knows really, other than those who've been inside it, how the machinations of government actually work. So when you took office and you were having discussions, who were you having discussions with, and who were you pushing? If you were pushing in the direction you've just articulated, who was pushing back and why?
So I was mainly speaking to officials within the department. You know, I come to this, as any minister does in a new department, with no real more information and insight than anybody else coming in from outside. I hadn't got
And this was your first job in government, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And so I hadn't had any postmasters that directly been involved in this as constituents. I had subsequently someone move into Sutton a year or so later. But at the time, I only knew what I'd seen from other, you know, from the media, which was I knew something big had happened, but I didn't really know the detail. And that's still the case for a lot of people now. You know, I hope that the drama that's coming on television will bring it to life. But there's still people that know when you talk about the Horizon scandal, they sort of and ah a little bit and know that there's something big, but they don't really know the detail. unless you've been directly involved in it. And so so I was speaking to civil servants officials in the department that look after the postal affairs, so that's the post office and Royal Mail, and of course people on, you know, on the board, and Nick Reed, the chief executive of post office, and so we talked from a government perspective about what we would and wouldn't do, and then obviously I'd speak to the post office and Nick Reed and the rest to see what their view was on it, and as I say, it just became apparent that we needed to do more, especially when it was we were just digging into the GLO's settlement and how much the funders had taken, so how little that the wronged postmasters had actually received. You know,
that actually apparently. That's a second. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. That's a second strand to it, because I know you were working on the compensation issue alongside the inquiry. But I mean, I was called up in the summer of 2020 after you'd announced the independent review into what had happened, and this is from someone whose name I haven't made public, but they said, we are limited in what we can do. The terms of the review were kicked between Bayes, that's your department, and number 10 before they finally reached an agreement on what the terms should be and how it should be structured. But the officials, i.e. the civil servants, weren't happy with anything. They didn't want a review. They didn't want an inquiry or anything. They wanted it all to go away. Now, is that a true reflection of your experience of dealing with the officials at Bayes? Because there strikes me that there's a conflict of interest with the civil servants at Bayes in that they are implicated in this scandal through the discussions they will have had with the post office during the GLO.
Yeah, I don't know if it's quite as cynical as that. I think, yeah, I think a lot of people want it to go away, but I'm not sure it's because they're implicated. I think it's more the fact that the civil servants service by default is driven by process, and it's up to ministers to then sort of shake up that process and set the strategy. And so it was very much like, there's the judiciary having made their pronouncement. There's a settlement. We don't want to get involved and start opening up a settlement. The inquiry, I know you talk about the inquiry, but the one drove the other. It's actually almost the unsatisfactory result of the settlement drove the need for the inquiry.
How so? Because that I thought they were two entirely separate things.
Well, so when I say drove it, I mean I drove it in my mind in terms of the fact that, look, this is job unfinished. It's just that it clearly wasn't a closed chapter. You had, as I say, all of that pages and pages of work by Justice Fraser about who did what, but we really hadn't got under the skin of it. But it was also, there were postmasters and former postmasters that were still suffering. So I always really saw the two together. So it's when it's when we got the inquiry up and running, and to be fair, getting the inquiry running, I didn't have to push that hard. But I deliberately did want a non-statutory inquiry, not because I didn't want to have people digging around. I literally just thought these postmasters have been suffering enough. And as we see from things like the COVID inquiry that's going on at the moment, how you've got that, you know, you've got the barrister in the COVID inquiry that's frankly sort of grandstanding slightly. And I'm not sure they're looking at the answers that people want in this kind of thing. What I didn't want to do is as I think I said on the floor of the House a few times, is for people to lawyer up. I didn't want money to go to legal representatives that could otherwise go to the people that needed it, the compensation. But then it became clear just that, you know, to get under the skin of what we needed to do, we needed that statutory inquiry.
Okay, well, that's interesting. You're skipping forward a little bit, because I'm, again, forgive me if I'm dragging you back to the early days. I think within 2 weeks of you taking office in February 2020, there was a Prime Minister's questions during which I think it was Lucy Allen asked a question of the Prime Minister. It was Lucy, yes, who said, will the Prime Minister today commit to launching an independent inquiry? And he came back immediately saying, I'm happy to commit to getting to the bottom of the matter in the way that she recommends. Did that have any impact or provide any impetus to your stated desire to get some kind of inquiry or review off the ground at the time?
I think it helped. It really helped. I think, number 10 can be a really closed building. at times. You know, everybody blames, it says, oh, it's number 10, it's number 10. You have to ask the question, who at number 10? Often the Prime Minister, you know, won't even get up to the Prime Minister, won't even necessarily get up to his private office. And there are 400 people in the building. So when someone comes back to me with anything saying, oh yeah, number 10 doesn't want this or number 10 wants this, you have to scratch around to find out who, rather than just relying on that as a chapter and verse. So it was really helpful. I'm not sure, I can't remember exactly that. I don't think I didn't get any pressure coming down saying, right, the Prime Minister says this, you must do that. It was almost the opposite. I used that, I sort of weaponized it. So, right, Prime Minister said this, that's really helpful to open the door for me to start the process and push harder.
Yes, and I think some of your backbench colleagues also started writing to the Prime Minister saying, so, okay, so what are the terms? When's it going to start running? And so it ran. So it's just interesting because to us on the outside, these are fine words. But obviously, if they are words which are on the record from the Prime Minister, it's comforting to know that they can be used as leverage internally within government to start making things happen. So that was the case in your experience.
Yeah, absolutely. No, definitely. Because something very early on, I thought as well, was that, I kept saying it, and I still believe it now, is that fine words are one thing. It's action that you need, because the people affected have had all of these words for, well, maybe the last 5 years or so, out of the 20 that they've suffered, but nobody has delivered. And it's all about delivery. You know, fine words do not get you your home back, don't get you your reputation back, etc. It's action. So use them for leverage, but then how do we keep the pace up and start a process, whether it's the inquiry or compensation?
And just paint a picture for us. You're a junior minister in your first post. You've taken on board the gravity of the situation for those involved. Had you taken on how important this was on a wider social and legal and political context? Had you seen the enormity of the scandal by, let's say, two or three months into post?
Yeah, I had. I think I was fortunate in the in my role in this instance that I had such a broad role covering lots of little things. So I was post affairs. So as I say, not just Horizon, but the future of the post office, the Royal Mail, and what was going on there as well. COVID had just hit, so I was doing hospitality, I was doing retail, I was doing small business. I was Minister for Labour Markets, so that's working conditions, how you get people back into work, how you allow all those kind of things. I was pushing the grants for businesses out of the door. I was looking at flexible working. I was looking at consumers. I was the Minister for Consumer and Minister for London. So I was doing lots of different things. And I remember the Secretary of State, well, you know, you talk about Alok Sharma, who was the Secretary of State at that beginning, but Kwasi Kwarteng later on said to me at one of our oral questions when we were sitting on the front bench together, he whispered to me, he said, you know what, I used to be Energy Secretary, so I can answer his questions, pointing at Greg Hands. He said, "I'm obviously the science is big money," so he's pointed to George Freeman, "I can answer his questions. The only minister I can't answer the questions for, you." So I was sort of not going under the radar, but they left me to get on with the job, which was great. They trusted me, and that was what was so great about that role. There were big things, but contained in small parts of the department. So that really helped me to just push in my own way, rather than having to go through this wider process of being man-managed and micromanaged by my boss.
And in terms of your officials, I've heard varying reports from department to department about how much resistance, and we all know the sort of Sir Humphrey stereotype, officials can give to youthful ministers coming in with a load of harebrained ideas that they soon manage to water down or kick quietly into the long grass. And I've heard contrasting reports of officials recognising that if a minister states something as a priority, they make it their priority to get something done. What was your experience of saying, no, I think we really need to have some kind of independent review and we need to start looking at proper compensation for the GLO claimants?
I actually found them really good to work with, the officials. There was just a natural inertia, but there was no Sir Humphrey pushback in that regard. There was an inertia because, as I say, just that division of constitutional division between the judiciary have had their say, etc. We didn't want to get involved in the litigation and relitigating it ourselves because it's a settlement by the post office. There was that sort of practical procedural point of view. But what I found really interesting was, I started off by saying this is the best thing I've done politically in politics. When we started to get to the compensation for the 555 and started that process down the line, I remember the same civil servants coming back to it. They felt empowered. I just got that impression that they felt liberated. And they were saying to me, you know what? Yeah, this is the best thing we've done as well. Because they could, I think there was that natural inertia. And once they felt a little bit released, we were really cracking on and working on it. I know it's job unfinished and, something I'll be speaking about later. But it was just interesting to see their journey as much as mine.
Mm. Did you get the slightest whiff of resistance? I go back to the point about backside covering, there being a conflict of interest, because you will have been speaking to officials who will have been advising the post office and working with the post office in their attempts to deny sub-postmasters justice throughout the GLO, because the government essentially allowed the post office to run that litigation.
Yeah, that's true. I don't actually remember really, getting that sense, because I think it was... They saw that I was going full tilt and it was not, a fair and a favour sort of thing. We just got to make sure that that we get everything across the line. And if this embarrasses my department, now there may be individuals there that might have been worried. They didn't really come across as that. But I made it really clear that if it's the department that's at fault, then tough. We just got to get it out there, because there's... From a political point of view, there were all three major parties involved in this over the 20 years, ministers from those things. So you can't blame it on the Labour Party or the Lib Dems or the Conservatives and what have you. It was an institutional failure.
But that sense that they wanted it all to go away, did you get that sense?
Well, only as I say, only in so much that I think procedurally they felt that had been exhausted. But I genuinely didn't get the impression at any time that one individual was covering their backside or they were worrying about their department in that sense. I think they was genuinely trying to separate the power of the process. I may have misread that. I think that's how I found it.
What was Nick Reed like? He's the chief executive of the post office, I ought to mention, just in case anyone isn't aware of that. So Nick Reed, chief executive of the post office, new broom, came in September 2019. What was he like when you spoke to him?
Yeah, I spoke to Nick about this, but also about the future of the post office. And I always got on well with Nick, and I found him very energetic, enthusiastic. And he had come from, NYSA, the Independent Supermarket Association, lots of small businesses working under that brand. I thought that was really interesting in terms of the future of the post office, because he knew how to run a membership organisation effectively, so you could recalibrate what was happening with sub postmasters in the ongoing process of running the post office. So I was quite enthused by that. I don't know if he got the enormity of the situation, of the Horizon scandal. He knew it was there. Obviously, that's why he separated the operation within the post office eventually, when the various compensation strands started. He realised this is way too big to, just to have as a standing sort of board operation. So he split the board in two. But I think that was quite overwhelming for him and the post office itself.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that the post office drastically underestimated by, I think, a factor of 9 the amount of money that applicants to the historical shortfall scheme would be claiming, and the fact that they messed up the administration of the historical shortfall scheme in failing to get any tax advice built into it or any provision for the huge amount of tax that claimants would end up paying if they got large awards, I think speaks volumes about their unpreparedness. But was there, I mean, I constantly hear from Lucy Allen's gone on the record about the arrogance of the post office lobbyists. And I've again spoken to an insider who talked about the regularity with which post office PR people and corporate affairs people were in and out of the business department, listening to what the minister wants and what government wants, and jumping as high as they as government demands. What's your experience of dealing with not just Nick Reed, but the post office in general? What was there an arrogance about the way they had dealt with sub-postmasters over the past 20 years. And did you see any signs, Nick Reed aside, that the organisation was capable of changing, let alone willing?
I didn't meet the whole board. I met various board members over various periods of time, but it was mainly head of comms and Nick that I would meet on a regular basis. I don't think it was arrogance. I think it was just there was a massive task in there. I think they were focused on that, and I think there was a sense of how do we just talk about the future rather than always dwelling in inverted commas in the past. And that is a difficult balance, to be fair. That is a difficult balance, because my fear, if this is a company, and it is a company, obviously, but if it's just a sole normal corporate company without any social impact and government involvement in this, it would have gone bust a long time ago. Least because it's a difficult business model, but because of the reputational damage of this situation. That would have definitely taken it under. But clearly, it is the post office. You know, this is something that people rely on day after day in rural areas, etc. So you can't just let it go.
Did you and your ministerial colleagues have any discussions about ending the post office's existence and replacing it with a different organisation which could do the job of the post office, but which would bring a new brand to the environment?
No, not at all. Never did. I didn't anyway. So we'd always looked at the future of the post office, and it's something that, especially at the last spending review, when we were looking at one of the, because we could probably should talk about the Treasury and all of this as well.
I was going to get to that. The huge amount of money that was released by the Treasury to pay for compensation. Can we get onto that in a moment? Because I want to get to the statutory inquiry announcement first.
No, absolutely. No, what I was going to say is that why that was because of the money that was coming from Treasury to sort of underwrite, if you like, the compensation. And the fact that we needed to keep the post office going in terms of the rural post offices. We gave them 50 million quid a year for the to keep the rural post offices open. The Treasury obviously took a big role in this. So we always looked about how we can review the post office to make sure it had a future, and it needed to look again at its business model, which is different from, as I say, just scrapping it and starting again under a new brand or a whole new corporation.
Okay, let's turn to the quashing of the convictions. The first convictions were quashed in December 2020, and then there was that huge moment on St George's Day in April 21, when the Court of Appeal agreed with the submissions from one of the sub-postmasters' teams that this was not just a lack of disclosure or a failure of decent investigative ability when it came to these prosecutions. This was not a technicality. This was an affront to the conscience of the court. It was a limb two category of abusive process. So that escalated it. And I had no idea as a non-legal person how important this was. But the legal world were very clear to point out this was very significant. And I think I'm right in saying, and I think Sir Wynne Williams, the retired judge who chairs your inquiry, who you appointed, came to you in the aftermath of that ruling and started having discussions with you about turning the inquiry into a statutory inquiry. What do you remember from that period?
That is exactly that. It was Sir Wynne that came up and said, look, I think we need to get, this is big, this is serious, it's very involved, it's going to be complicated. You're right about that pronouncement, and so therefore I believe it should be statutory. By that stage, I think I'd sort of agreed anyway, so it was a very easy conversation to have. We were then away. So I know, as I say, the only reason that I didn't make it statutory in the first place was to try and keep it simple so that we could get through it in good time. We can see the fact that the statutory inquiry is still going on. It was supposed to finish. It was supposed to finish the year before last, and then it extended it to September this year, and it's still going. So it's going beyond its first extension. So it shows the complexity of it, but it also shows what happens when you really start scratching under the surface with in that statutory format.
But again, I mean, it's easy to see all this as inevitable. The settlement of the GLO was by no means inevitable. The decision of the Court of Appeals by no means inevitable. To what extent do you sort of feel carried along by events and reacting to them as they happen? Or Did you feel like you had control of the process? I mean, even getting agreement for the statutory inquiry, you would have had the knowledge that that was going to cost an awful lot more money. So who had to sign that off? Was that you, or did you have to go above your own head to say, look, I think this needs to be statutory. I'm going to need a pot of money to pay for this. Please, can you agree it?
I think that was a relatively easy decision to be made. I think the officials were there as well. Officials were talking to Treasury all the way through this, and the permanent secretary that looks after obviously the overall budget and of the department. And so again, I don't think that was a particular issue. Where we had more of a pressure to get is when we had needed that bigger money for the to be able to underwrite the compensation schemes. That was a bigger challenge to get signed off by Treasury. But the statutory inquiry, to be fair, was a relatively easy decision. I think it was just apparent to all we needed to do it. And as I say, it was less to do with expense. It was more just the timescale and a length of process and the further anguish for the people that were involved. That was my only drive within that.
I mean, were there officials within government, and this is just speculation from someone who doesn't know anything about the way these things work, were there officials who would have been wargaming this, working out what would have happened if the convictions were or weren't quashed, how that would then affect the way that the department went about administering the review or the inquiry or looking at compensation? I don't know whether you're sort of proactive or reactive to events as they happen as a department and as a minister, because you explained all your responsibilities. I can't imagine you had that much time to think about what was happening in post office land.
No, I didn't, but it was just something that, as I say, being a human being, as I say, as you know, and I've seen say this at the dispatch box, being a human being, it was a massive driver, because I was reacting to a lot of things that at that time, where a lot of people were suffering business wise in COVID sense, and obviously personally in this post office, the Horizon scandal. So it was just doing the right thing. It was relatively easy to feel it rather than have to go through, you know, detail and process. You just instinctively knew what was the right thing to do in this kind of instance. So did they war game it? Not to that extent. I think they obviously, when we got to the compensation, it was okay, fine, you know, where are the options and what kind of scheme or approach do we take from it? And you know, there's option A, B and C, minister, what do you want to go for, that kind of thing. But I'm not sure we war gamed it to that extent.
And let's just talk about the release of that two-thirds of £1 billion, which was quietly announced by the Treasury in December 2021. This was clearly a recognition that this scandal was far-reaching. It touched many, many people. It was going to cost a huge amount to administer, as we've seen with the cumulative lawyers' fees that have been involved in this. And people whose lives had been ruined and had managed to get their convictions overturned were due a serious amount of compensation. How did you secure such a large sum from the Treasury?
Let me go back to that, because yeah, this is the thing. The Treasury rules are really arcane, and it's been a source of frustration, probably across government, but certainly with me, over a number of issues. Because you literally have to do value for money checks and things like that. Well, you know, value for money, and we're talking about the kind of 20-year scandal that we're talking about, the biggest miscarriage of justice in British history, British court history. How do you do a value for money check on that? But it has an impact on the overall spending review and a period, and therefore what the department can spend, what it can it needs to borrow, its borrow requirements, and those kind of things. It has a wide impact, but nonetheless, when you're just trying to get money out the door, it's hugely difficult. So I had some. Well, we did twofold, I think, from memory. We sort of, put together the figures. These are the likely figures that are going to be coming out, and this is what we're going to need. We had to keep the post office solvent, obviously, because this gets added on to the post office's own accounts, if you like. And as soon as they start handing out money and announcing compensation, if you pay the first person, then you're on hook for the rest of it. So the post office itself risked being solvent or not, and so we had to make sure that we could stage that and make sure that we could guarantee it, show that we were guaranteeing it as Treasury, which obviously kept everything then therefore you know, being market sensitive, that it was above board. So it was a very technical procedure, but I think we also just sold it to the Treasury as something we had to do. Rightly so. One, to keep the post office running. Two, to actually compensate people fairly, and make sure that we can get through this process. But we do it in a way that actually fitted in with those Treasury rules. It took a long time, most of which was like the iceberg that I didn't even see happening, that officials really lent into. By that time, as I say, they were very, very empowered to make sure this happened.
Do you feel you bear any personal responsibility for the delays to compensation? We've heard, I think, only a very, very small number of people who've had their convictions quashed have got full and final compensation. Although most of the historical shortfall scheme has been completed, there are still people waiting who've been waiting for more than 3 years now to get the compensation that they've been asking for. Given the piecemeal way that these compensation schemes were set up and the huge delays that have been suffered by sub-postmasters, can you look back and say, actually, we shouldn't have done it this way, we should have got an independent arbiter in, we should have done it this, you know, do you bear responsibility for any of the delay?
Yeah, if I'd had my time again, I would have taken it in-house and done it, you know, with the help of an independent arbiter. I think we were trying to give, you know, the post office were playing catch up. It's in that regard, they were coming up with their scheme. I think by the time we realised this was going to be at risk of delay and complication, we'd gone probably too far down the line. But yeah, I'd have definitely tried to you know, manage it myself if I'd known that was the case.
What do you think of the current incumbent, Kevin Hollenrake's decision to set up the Horizon Compensation Advisory Board?
I think it's a really good idea. We've been talking about that before I left. And Kevin Jones and James Arbuthnot, Lord Arbuthnot, are hugely brilliant additions. Kevin's a really good minister. He's got a different style to me, but he's got a business mind. He's got a really business brain. He used to badger me all the time about you know, banking scandals, you know, similar to this but smaller, but quite niche in some ways, quite complicated scandals where people have been bankrupted by banks. He talked to me about whistleblowers all the time, so he's got this kind of you know, vibe that will really drill down into you know, what's going on, and I hope that continues, because this is still way, way too long to conclude. And Kevin Jones and Lord Arbuthnot really do, they've been really good. Speaking to me in the background when I was minister, there were things that, you know, they would ask me, I'd be pushing on the floor of the House, and then we'd have a conversation saying, look, I've got to push you on this. I know you're trying to do this. What can we do to help informally, etc., etc.? In fact, it was Lord Arbuthnot that actually helped me unlock the compensation in the first place for the 555 and reopening that, because we really had a bit of a standoff with Alan Bates for a while, where we were tiptoeing around each other. And actually, you know, what I used to say on the floor of the House was sometimes I would announce something that we'd get this done in weeks. And a lot of that was actually to face back and to play brinkmanship with my own government. So, right, I've said it now, we've got to get this done. And then I asked Lord Arbuthnot for Alan Bates' telephone number, and which he gave me, and I rang up Alan and said, right, how do we sort this out? Sometimes it's just as, you know, I crossed the divide that officials were sort of sometimes saying, I'm not sure, that's a brave decision, Minister, kind of thing.
That's really interesting, because that just demonstrates in a way, when you do have your hands on at least one lever of power, if you pull it and you're confident in the way you're going about it, you can actually get something done, which is, I think sometimes there must be a temptation for ministers to hide behind process if they don't want to get something done or they don't consider it a priority.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I used to run small businesses before I was elected, so I'm used to taking a decision, implementing that decision, and then living or dying on it. You know, I will celebrate my successes and, you know, own up to my failures, kind of thing. That's how you have to do it as a self-employed or, you know, running small businesses. You have no other choice. And so I try and do my politics in the same way. How can I add value? What can I do?
What do you therefore think of the Horizon Compensation Advisory Board's call or letter to the Lord Chancellor suggesting that every single post office prosecution or successful conviction that they secured during the period that Horizon was active can be now demonstrated to be unsafe, not just on the basis that the Horizon IT system was unsafe, but that the entire prosecution function of the post office was deeply dysfunctional?
Over, in principle, I think that's probably sensible. You know, I know that just speaking to Nick Reed and others in the post office, that they were pretty clear that there were cases that Horizon had absolutely nothing to do with it, and there were clear fraudulent cases within that. I think you do get to a point, though, in the same way that I was saying that, you know, given my time, I'd sort of just bring it in and get the compensation done. I think it comes to a point when you've just got to say, this is going on for so long, and are you really going to hold this up? You've already made enough mistakes, for goodness sake, over 20 years. Just get through it. And so I think there is a case to look at that. I don't know the details, so I would need to, you know, if I was the decision maker at the time, I would really want to drill into that detail and test it. So if you're talking about the, you know, should everybody just, you know, be appeal be allowed, etc. I think I would want, if I was the decision maker, I would just want to just test with the post office, because I remember the post office say to me, Nick Reed and others say, there are definite cases where fraud, it was a clear fraud, the Horizon was nothing to do with it. But there comes a point in my mind that actually you've just got to, rather than people doing this piecemeal, I was speaking to Scott Mann, one of my colleagues, who was himself a postie, around the postmaster. He has had a constituent that has actually literally got driven out of their village, and they moved abroad as a result of this of Horizon. They got driven out of their country, never mind their community. Just get the thing done. So I think there comes a point when you've got to get this done. So I'm very sympathetic to that call to just have a blanket, let's move on.
Well, I think there are two points here. One is it's better than 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person has a criminal conviction, and that it, that would be a blanket quashing of these convictions, I guess, would be that principle in action. There's also the point made by Professor Christopher Hodges to the Lord Chancellor, which is that these people have served their punishment anyway. And whilst I accept that, of course, you will get some people within those, I think it's like 900 plus convictions over a 15-year period, who will have been guilty of a criminal offence. The fraction or the percentage seems to be vanishingly small. And of course, what we're now seeing about the post office's prosecution function was that it was so inept. I'm not sure the leadership of the post office can rely on it to say with any confidence there was definite criminal activity going on, because the investigations just weren't good enough.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And so that's why, you know, in principle, I'm in agreement with it. I would just test it a little bit. But for the reasons that you've said, I think that would, you know, my personal decision probably would be to accept that and go with that rather than just this piecemeal approach that's happening at the moment.
Okay, if I may, I'm going to take you back into your time as minister. And I asked you this question when you were serving for the BBC podcast that we did about Paula Venables and her CBE. Knowing what you now know, and I appreciate that she hasn't yet given evidence to the inquiry, do you think there is a case for stripping her of her CBE?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, like when I'm sitting in places, I can say so much. But, you know, what we're trying to do, again, it's the careful nature of being a minister, is what I didn't want to do is preempt anything. I'm a backbench MP now. So what I want, I think, reasonably, I think people do need to be held to account. And that includes Paula Venables for trying to recuse the judge in the case, and for trying to outspend the 555. I think Fujitsu need to be held to account for this, because I'm not sure why the taxpayer needs to be on the hook for a lot of this compensation when the taxpayer had no knowledge of this. And so there's a lot more work that needs to be done in this.
So you think Paula Venables should lose her CBE specifically because of her behaviour in allowing the post office to take this to a toe-to-toe litigation and the tactics therein, i.e. the recusal of the judge and the aggressive way it was run?
I think from what I see of this, and bear in mind this happened before my time, and I didn't dwell on those details because it was just, I was focusing on what I could do at the time. But from what I see of it, the tactics used by the Paula Venables led post office were pretty horrendous, and that needs to be, people need to be held to account.
If you were in her shoes, what would you have done?
Well, I'd hope I'd have, as I say, in the same way that now, because you asked me earlier on about government and how government might be held to account, I sort of said, well, I don't care. You know, hold us to account, because we've done wrong. If we've done wrong, you know, then it needs to come out. And the post office clearly have done wrong, and I think that does need to come out. So you've got... I would have gone to I'm not sure how much government knew about it. I would have gone to the shareholder and say, right, this is what's happened. I'd be far more open and transparent about it. You know, she's not going to come out into the public and say, right, okay, fine. And thrown open everything because there's a commercial undertaking that the post office has as well. But I would have done more to make sure we could actually bring this to a proper end rather than just trying to game it.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting because it is entirely possible that's exactly what she did do, go to government and say, look, we've got a serious problem here. We think we might be sitting on a whole bunch of miscarriages of justice. We can't let this come out in public because it's going to kill the post office and stop it being viable as a going concern. And the advice she got from the government was to keep fighting.
Well, let's see. That's the kind of thing that needs to come out in the inquiry because, but what you don't do, doubling down on that and then to the point that they had to bring in the funders. The 555 had to bring in the funders, which ultimately squeezed both sides. Pushed out 55 million quid worth of compensation, of which they pocketed the most. Nice work if you can get it, kind of thing. But they should never have been in the position that the 555 needed to find those funders.
Were you ever involved in any discussions about the appropriateness of Paula Venables sitting on the board of the Cabinet Office, a post she took up immediately after she left the post office during the group litigation?
No. I can't remember if she had the role at the time, but when I came in. But either way, I wouldn't have been involved in that, and I definitely wasn't involved in that discussion, no.
You overlapped by a month or two, I think. Right, I wondered whether or not the because again, Paula Venables essentially was accountable to the board, which is accountable to the shareholder, which was the government, and she was rewarded for her role with the CBE and with the seat on the Cabinet Office and with a nice chairmanship of an NHS trust thereafter. It's only when the sub postmasters managed to essentially break open the scale of this scandal that I think the government realised that the game was up, and you were suddenly in a position where you were in a position to do something about it. And a lot of people do give you a huge amount of credit for being that first minister to grasp the nettle and really get on with things. But I'm just the whole reason I think for having this conversation is because I just wanted to know what resistance you found yourself coming across, because this was a government, this was a machine that was dead set against the postmasters getting anywhere at one stage.
So look, I think the thing is with the positions and the honours, they go through a separate strand of government. And as you say, it overlapped. It didn't really come across my radar at the time of appointments. But nonetheless, to start to unwind that, when we were setting up the inquiry, what was really, especially when it was non-statutory, because bearing in mind the statutory, you can bring people in, compel people to come in front of you. Non-statutory, you can't. So what I was trying to do is make sure they didn't rock the boat to the point that actually people wouldn't comply. And so we got very early doors. We got Paula Venables, we got the rest of the post office, we got the Fujitsu to say, yes, we are going to abide by this and work with the inquiry, whether it's non-statutory or statutory, which I think is important, and it still remains important. Because although I've said what I've said, you know, I really do hope they continue to work with that, because that's the, you know, at the end of the day, I know postmasters want a sense of justice and that accountability in terms of action. But first of all, they need the answers to the questions. And if they're not, if Paula Venables and Fujitsu are not going in front of the inquiry because they take their ball home, as it were, then they're not going to get those questions answered. And I think that's really important. And it's important for us to make sure that this doesn't happen again. I know I feel really glib saying that, because every time we have one of these kind of inquiries, everyone says, let's make sure it never happens again. And then we always find that human nature kicks in and it does happen again. And I don't really know what the answer is.
Lord Arbuthnot is absolutely certain, and he's said on the record that he's certain, that there was a conspiracy to pervert the course of justice at the post office, which is a criminal offence. What culpability do you think civil servants who were involved in discussions with the post office, knowing full well that there were people who had perhaps received unsafe convictions, what culpability do civil servants have in potentially conspiring to pervert the course of justice over this scandal?
Well, I think that needs to go through a process. I don't think I can really comment on it, because it's not something I saw or got a sense of.
But looking at it now from the outside, having been much better informed perhaps than you were 4 years ago, 3 years ago, what do you see malign intent somewhere along the way?
I didn't see it. I never really saw it. And if there is something that, if there was malign intent, that needs to come out. That absolutely needs to come out. But I wouldn't want to prejudge that, because it's just not something that I really came across my radar. I mean, James Arbuthnot has been working on this way, way longer than me, and he was just really in the weeds with this for a long time. So he'll have a longer term view on some of the detail. Yeah, I think my role has always been, first of all, to, and thanks for your book, it's really instructive to give the background from it, but to bring a human form to it and humanise it. But secondly, it was to be in the moment and actually make the decisions there and then, rather than try and re-prosecute previous stages of the process.
Well, you're still involved. You're going to speak in a debate today in Parliament. What do you hope your contribution will be?
Well, I really just want to keep them on the toes in terms of make sure that that everybody remembers how we need to keep the impetus on this. The civil service have this phrase when they always say working at pace. I never know really what working at pace means, but what if it's, you can have a fast pace or a slow pace. We just got to get on with this, because people are still suffering as a result. And I was listening back to one of your podcasts with Kevin Hollenrake when back in March, I think you recorded it, when you're talking about the fact that you're going to get everything done by August, by his deadline. And he was very hopeful that he would. This bill is obviously extending that deadline. But let's hope it doesn't need to get used.
And finally, in many ways, 2024 could be the biggest year this scandal has in terms of public awareness. We've got the drama coming up at the beginning of the year. Then we'll have a lot of high-profile former executives at the post office giving evidence in the statutory inquiry, and the hope that most of the people who deserve compensation will be put into a process whereby they're definitely going to get the money that they deserve soon, or will have already received their full and final settlement. What are your hopes for the direction this goes in 2024?
My hope is that we can wrap this up, so we can be here next Christmas. People can be brought back to where they were before the detriment happened, that we can have the answers that we need, that the people who are culpable can actually be held responsible for and held to account for their actions, that we can bring this to a satisfactory conclusion. It's a dark, dark chapter in British court history, in the post office. We've got to bring an end to it for those people, and as I say, for the post office itself, because the post office provides a hugely valuable service to hundreds of thousands of people, and it's got to have a future, but it won't be able to sort that future out unless we actually get this done. I've no idea how long I've got left in Parliament, whether it's a general election, whether it's my decision or whatever that brings an end to it, but I'm determined that I use every day, the remaining to help this along now.
Paul Scully, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Dave.
That's it for another episode of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. Our thanks to Paul Scully for his time. As Nick mentioned, there are going to be big developments in the post office story in 2024, so please follow this podcast on your usual podcast platform, or sign up to Nick's secret email, which you can find on his website, postofficescandal.uk. Investigating the Post Office Scandal is written, produced, edited and presented by me, Rebecca Thompson, and Nick Wallace, with production assistance from Whistledown Productions. The Whistledown team, Nick and I, would like to wish you a very happy festive season and a prosperous new year. Goodbye.